The third case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Farrell Dillon. For Mr. Dillon, we have Mr. Timothy Wrench, an attorney from Rapid City. And for the Appalachian State of South Dakota, we have Ms. Sherry Sundemwald, an assistant or deputy attorney general from Pierre. And Justice Cohen Camp has entered a disqualification in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robin Hellman, a circuit judge from the Second Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Cohen Camp's place. Mr. Wrench, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank you for granting oral argument on this very important case. This is a case where Farrell Dillon was convicted of raping his daughter twice and her friends in the summer of 1998. It is a retrial, and it is our contention that during the course of this retrial, serious errors occurred which caused the result to be unreliable and require a new trial. In that regard, I'd like to turn directly to my first issue, which goes to the heart of really the case. The first issue that I've raised on appeal in this matter is whether the trial court erred in denying a motion for judgment of acquittal when KD, the daughter, outright denied penile contact with her vagina. The state proceeded under the theory that Farrell Dillon took his daughter and her friends when they were 7 or 8 years old into his bedroom and one after another attempted to place his penis into their vaginas. That's the theory of the state's case from the beginning through the end. And it is our contention here that KD, when she was testifying under oath at this trial, despite all of the other evidence in the record, clarified the situation and said something which requires that acquittals be entered reference to the counts involving her. Specifically, when she was asked, "What did your father do with his penis to your vagina?" Answer, "He didn't do anything with his penis with my vagina." By the court, "I couldn't hear your answer. I'm sorry." Answer, "I said he didn't do anything with his penis with my vagina." Question, "His penis did not go into your vagina, is that correct?" Answer, "Yes." "And that's what you told the detective long ago?" "Yes." "So there was never a point in time when your father's penis went inside your vagina, is that, or in your vagina, correct?" "Yes." It is our contention that when you utilize the theory that a litigant cannot rise above their own sworn testimony, that testimony in and of itself required entry of judgments of acquittal as it related to KD.
Mr. Wrench, isn't the state the litigant? She is a victim and maybe a complaining witness, but she's not a litigant, is she?
It's true. She's not a litigant per se in the fact that she's not the party. But the state is bound by her testimony. The state is coming forth and attempting to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they can show that Farrell Dillon attempted to place his penis in her vagina. Here, she says it didn't happen, that that's not what happened. In the state's own position in the case in chief, as they went through the direct examination, they asked her what had occurred. She didn't say anything even like this, and she did not testify in any way that there was any type of a penetration that occurred. It's true she's not the litigant, but the state is bound by her testimony, and her testimony is under oath. Now, the obvious response is, she may have said something different before on videotape or may have said something different before to officers. And the question becomes, she takes a position under oath before the very jury, which is trying the case, when asked these questions in response to her testimony, how can the state ever rise above that? How can they rise above it when she says it without equivocation?
Well, what about the question doesn't seem to track the definition in the code, which is penetration, however slight.
That's correct.
Well, and that's not the question you asked.
No, it's not the question I asked. However, the answer to the question that I asked said he didn't do anything with my vagina with his penis. And the state is proceeding under the theory that he's committed the crime of rape by attempting to put his penis into her vagina. She says he didn't do anything with it. There's no dispute that she knows what the word vagina means. How do we rise above that? It's pretty much that simple relative to counts 1 and 2 involving KD. With that said, there is no reasonable way one could look at this evidence and find Farrell Dillon guilty of those two matters based upon the theory that the state started with at the very beginning of the case and ended with in their final words to the jury. Her testimony negates that. Her testimony disproves it to such an extent that a judgment for acquittal should have been granted at that point in time.
But with the other evidence in the record, about the other statements, for instance, to the social worker, to the effect that it hurt because he was pushing too hard, and they did sex and it hurt bad. I mean, at that point, doesn't become a jury decision.
Well, no, it doesn't. And the reason for that is this. She's coming into court and she's saying that he did nothing to her vagina with his penis, and she's saying that under oath. Any other statements she made previously, those were not statements that were under oath. Certainly they were admissible for the various reasons they were admissible. But on the flip side of that, she also told the social worker her father had never touched her. She also told the officer, right before she told the social worker that her father had never touched her, that no, my dad didn't touch me. So there comes a point when you have these competing statements, it can become a jury issue. But do we really want a ruling of law where the alleged victim can essentially make a statement that negates the possibility of the rape that the state is attempting to prosecute under their clear theory, and then find other reasons to try to support it? If he did nothing to her, if he didn't do anything with his penis with her vagina, how can he be convicted of rape when the method that they're claiming that the rape occurred was the use of the penis and having it attempting to go into the vagina? So it's our position that when she makes that statement under oath, that we should utilize the cannot rise above the own plainly stated testimony and claim a version of the facts better than that given in the testimony, and that should be grafted into the criminal law. In fact, it was grafted into the habeas law in Hopflinger versus Leapley, as I've cited in my brief. So it does have application, and it makes sense. Why should, when you have a reasonable doubt standard and proof beyond a reasonable doubt, if an alleged victim says under oath that the method and manner in which they're claiming the rape occurred didn't happen, that should be the end of the question. That should be the end of the question. I wish the jury would have seen it that way. They did not. I'd like to move to the second issue that I'd like to raise. It's actually the fifth issue in the brief, and it is whether the circuit court erred in refusing to grant a new trial when it was learned two jurors brought extraneous information into the jury room, shared it with the other jurors, and when that very information was excluded in the trial in limine upon Rule 403. I want to clarify something at the outset. In my brief, I made the contention that there was a specific factual finding of prejudice. I went back, looked at the transcripts. The court didn't say anything specific about prejudice. We made the motion to have this type of information excluded. That is, that Darryl Dillon was previously convicted, that he went to prison, that he received a new trial because of ineffective assistance of counsel, and things of that nature upon relevance and 403. It's our position that that type of information, while irrelevant, could only be prejudicial, and that's the very basis and the reason that it would be kept out in the first place. Our motion did rest on Rule 403. The state did not object to it at that time. It was granted that the state could not bring in facts that Darryl Dillon had previously been tried, had previously been convicted, that the Supreme Court had reversed it, and that his previous lawyer was incompetent, for obvious reasons, because there are many ways that that information can be misused.
Well, and doesn't the fact his previous lawyer was incompetent actually helps him, wouldn't it?
Well, you know,
maybe he'd have been acquitted if he'd had a competent lawyer.
Well, you know, in ordinary parlance, I suppose one could view it that way if they wanted to. But think about this. What do we think when we think of people getting habeas relief and things like that and utilizing the word ineffective assistance of counsel and incompetent attorney and things like that? What a person thinks of, or what a normal person thinks of, is a technicality. Oh, this person is saying that it's all their lawyer's fault. And what else do we know that it shows that is even greatly outweighs any possible good benefit of an incompetent attorney? It shows a prior conviction. It shows a prior determination by another jury on these same facts with these same witnesses that an individual was adjudged to be guilty of the offense. And it's something like that that is so corrosive and so dangerous when dealing with the presumption of innocence. And that's why the information should be kept out at the very beginning. So, yes, I suppose one person could say, oh, maybe that would help him. But the harm that it would cause would be far greater than that, because you mark him as a criminal. You mark him as a convict. You mark him as someone who's untruthful, who a jury didn't believe. You mark him as somebody who's a child molester and is looking for a reason to get out of prison and things of that nature. To that extent, that's the very reason that it was kept out in the first place.
Didn't the court, though, weigh this and the fact that depositions or transcripts were used throughout this trial, and they were obviously 10 years old, jurors aren't dumb. They're very perceptive.
Wasn't that already brought before them?
Well, you know, I did make a motion in limine to exclude that. When I was cross-examining the alleged victims, I was using the prior transcripts precisely the way we were supposed to and precisely in the method I was told to do it, which was refer to it as a prior transcript. The witnesses were supposed to be told not to refer to a prior jury trial. Each party was to instruct their witnesses not to say that because this prior trial thing is a dangerous fire to play with. And two of the alleged victims, when I'm using the previous transcripts, say, oh, you mean the previous trial. So it's true that came into the record, and that's what prompted an instruction that told the jury not to consider a previous trial. And as to what a jury juror thinks about a previous trial or why it may have taken 10 years, I don't know that that can automatically be said to be a leap that a juror would make. There are many reasons why things could take a long period of time. But one thing we know is that the court had determined at the outset that that information wasn't supposed to come in. Some of it did. We tried to deal with it. But then what we find is the jurors are bringing it in at the very end in the most important time of the trial, the deliberations themselves, and talking about this, why did this take so long? And you'll note when they said, why did this take so long? You don't have jurors saying, now this was because it was a retrial or something like that. You have a male juror who's a truck dispatcher saying in a loud and definitive voice, the guy's been in the penitentiary for 10 years, like that. So the jurors were wondering about it. We get this penitentiary at the very beginning of the deliberations, starting it off, and then we get this information into the record at the very end of the deliberations before the verdict has been taken that it's as a result of the ineffective assistance of counsel or incompetent counsel or something like that. What you have here is a situation that is the criminal equivalent and maybe even worse than Russell versus Takata, which is the latest pronouncement of this court on jury misconduct.
Well, let's bring up that case because you happen to have the same trial judge in both cases. And Russo, she looks at a two-week trial and says, this was prejudicial. I'm granting a new trial. She looks at your entire trial and says, I'm not granting a new trial. Aren't we supposed to? She was there. We weren't. Aren't we supposed to give that trial judge deference?
Well, I don't think you are supposed to give the trial judge deference. And the reason for that is this. In Russell versus Takata, you held that the grant of a new trial is more favored than the denial of a new trial. And in this particular case, the misconduct, that is the bringing in of the information that the prosecution wasn't allowed to bring in itself, that creates a presumption of prejudice. And what the court in this case, the trial court in this case did, was apply a subjective standard as to whether it had an impact on this particular jury rather than applying the objective standard of what a reasonable, typical, normal, rational juror would think in hearing this type of information. It's for that reason that the circuit court erred. The circuit court also in this case, you know, we had evidentiary battles all the way through the thing. I was at odds with the circuit court, as I often am, it seems like, in these cases, and it's nothing personal to the judge or anything like that, but we were battling all the way through. I mean, we go to a hearsay issue that is often one of the remaining issues. I don't get to bring my information in, and there are three separate instances where the state gets to bring hearsay in. There's problems with this case, and this wasn't applied fairly. You know, if you look at the factors of Russell versus Takata, here we have more jurors knowing the information by even the state's admission, possibly up to 10. They said all but two jurors heard the information. In Russo, I think the number was 6. In Russo, the information was discussed for 3 to 5 minutes. In this case, at the beginning of the jury deliberations, the information about the penitentiary and retrial was discussed for 3 to 5 minutes. And then at the very end of the deliberations, but before the vote was taken, you have additional information coming in about the incompetence of the lawyer. And in addition to that, in Russo, the circuit court was willing to look at the juror who provided the source of the misconduct and challenge the juror's credibility, whereas here, we have two jurors who literally lied under oath about what occurred. The first juror was a male truck dispatcher who stated in a loud and definitive voice that this guy was in the penitentiary for 10 years. He was identified by other jurors. He denied it under oath that ever occurred. The second juror who was the
person...
Did
the trial court make a finding he was a liar?
No. The trial court did not make a finding that he was a liar. The trial court didn't even address that point. And then, on top of that, the juror at the end who said, that she was the source of the information about the incompetent counsel. You'll recall that she was the one who was a former neighbor of the chief investigating officer, and she wouldn't tell us who she obtained this information from. Was said it was from some acquaintance who was familiar with the facts of the case. She'd signed an affidavit before testifying that she'd heard that information, but she didn't know where it came from. So, I mean, objectively looking at the matter, you have two jurors who are literally violating their oath and who aren't being completely truthful about it, and it has to come out through the courses of the hearing. In essence, what we have here is we have a far worse situation than it was in Russo. This information was the subject of a motion in limine, in and of itself. Had the state brought this information before the jury intentionally, the way the jurors brought it into the deliberations, there's no doubt that a mistrial would have been granted. And to say that it's overwhelming, you know, I can see that in a case if you've got a bloody fingerprint or something like that, or evidence that's undeniable, but this is a he said, she said case that's based upon the statements of girls versus the statements of the defendant, no physical evidence which backs it up, no injuries to the young girls that would be consistent with later claims that they were fully penetrated and things like that. So this is far from an overwhelming case. Yes, same judge looks at it in a civil case and grants a new trial, looks at it in a criminal case, doesn't grant a new trial. Fact of the matter is a criminal case, there's so much more at stake than there is in a civil case because you're dealing with the very liberty of an individual, the lifeblood of what we all value here in society, that it should almost be more favored that a new trial would be given when you have this very information that's kept out because of its prejudicial nature and how unfair it can be that when it's brought into the jury room by one of the jurors. Should not have happened. It was not fairly decided by the circuit court. The circuit court erred by not entering facts into the record or findings into the record that would support the misconduct itself, and even then erred in saying the presumption was overcome by the state by simply saying the case was so overwhelmingly powerful that that it would have been convicted anyway. That's not the case here. This case, the girls were all over the place. The daughter said it happened, it didn't happen, it didn't happen, and then it happened, and then at trial said nothing happened, penis to vagina. The other girls variously said things like, it happened, I wasn't there. You know, SRB said several times she wasn't even there on the evening, which later is the evening for which a conviction is entered relating to her. She said repeatedly that her father didn't want her over that particular night. He thought things were happening to me over there, but they weren't. Things like that. TT, who was one of the charges initially, but who was dismissed because of a prior acquittal, she said it didn't even happen to her, and they still charge her with it. The sisters, LR and NR, have very inconsistent statements and different statements about how they claim things occurred. NR said it never happened to the doctor when she claims at trial that it happened. LR said that it only happened once and then twice, and then her sister was there, and then her sister wasn't there. SRB indicated that it never happened in Farrell's bedroom, yet the state proceeds under the theory that it always happened in Farrell's bedroom. All kinds of differences here, all kinds of differences. This is a very important issue, and this misconduct should not have occurred. But for this misconduct, we would be in a situation where I believe we would have won that case for what that's worth. But even with that misconduct, one thing is certain, the trial was not fair as a result. The next issue I would like to go to is the issue on the improper vouching and the refusal to grant a mistrial. That is whether the court erred in refusing to grant a mistrial when the state's psychiatric expert improperly vouched for the credibility of the alleged victims of the child sexual abuse, which in turn prejudiced Dylan as to the credibility of these alleged victims. This doctor who was called to the stand by the state in response to kind of a conclusionary question to sum it up, tells this jury, I missed one of the most important ones, meaning the characteristics of abused children, and that is when somebody reports being sexually abused, in the majority of the cases, that's the truth, that's the one. That's what this expert says before this jury at the outset of the trial, about 200 pages into it, before the alleged victims testified. We made a motion for a mistrial. The court did not grant the motion. The court, however, issued a limiting instruction, and it's our position here but this type of information, it'd be just about like saying the guy failed a polygraph. That when you have an expert come in with his degrees and he says in the majority of the cases when they say this, it's the truth, that's very corrosive and caustic to the presumption of innocence, and that a curative instruction in and of itself does not cure that. Especially in a case like this where we have outright proof that the jurors did not follow the instructions. 23 separate times, the jurors were told and admonished not to talk to others, and if people talked to them, they were supposed to report it to the court. And at the close of this case, we know that we have two jurors that are bringing in extrinsic information and not reporting it to the court. You can't presume that the jury is following the instructions as given, and because of that, this type of information is so powerful coming into this jury at the outset of the case, it would be our contention that it is something that requires reversal. The other issues that I have the issue about the children's shoes being placed in the hallway. Granted, it wasn't by the state, but it's our position that that's prejudicial and the failure of the court not to allow us to produce our exculpatory evidence. I see that my time is finished.
Thank you, Mr. Ranch. Ms. Sundemall, do you have 20 minutes?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sherry Sundemwald, and I'm representing the state in this argument today. The defendant was convicted on two counts of first-degree rape against his own 8-year-old daughter. The first of those rapes occurred on July 10, 1998, at her slumber party. The second rape occurred on September 11, 1998, after a General Beadle School Elementary School birthday party. He was also convicted on three counts of criminal pedophilia. One count was against SRB. That incident occurred on July 10, 1998, during the birthday party, slumber party. The fourth count occurred against LR. That occurred on September 11, 1998. And the fifth count for which he was convicted was also criminal pedophilia against NR, LR's older sister. That again happened on September 11, 1998. The facts of this case, I think, are very important, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about them.
Let me just interrupt you on that as far as the facts. Other than the children's testimony, what other evidence supports the rape the charges?
Well, there is no medical evidence. Each one of the girls, all five, were examined by a medical doctor, and there was no physical evidence. But the medical doctor said that's not unusual. Oftentimes, you do not have medical evidence after a child has been raped. And there was actually quite a bit of testimony in terms of penetration, and it went to the answer, or an answer I think Justice Gilbertson talked about.
But as far as evidence of it happening, it really depended on these children's testimony.
Absolutely. There was no other adult witness to this. Physical evidence. But there's five victims in one way or another. Those five victims are 7 and 8 years old when this happened in 1998. KD, his daughter, LR, who was 7, NR, her sister, who was 8, SRB, who was 7, and TT, who was 7. In October of 1998, LR's mom asked LR if she wanted to spend the night with KD, and there's evidence that these kids all loved going over to KD's house. They spent a lot of time there. There's evidence that the defendant was doing a pretty good job of grooming these girls. They had Nintendo. He brought them to the park. He brought them out to restaurants to eat. They had fun going to their house. They liked going to his house. All of a sudden, that changed. And LR's mom was confused, and so she asked the older sister, why doesn't LR want to go to Katie's house anymore? And NR told her mom, defendant tried to put his thing into her. And it happened to LR, too. So mom reports this to law enforcement, and law enforcement does interviews. First LR and NR. And LR immediately is upset. She's crying. Her head is on the table. She said it happened after the General Beadle school party on September 11th, 1998. And this was by now October of 1998. And of course, these girls were told by defendant, don't tell anyone. But LR now talks and she says he tried to put his thing in her. And he says he did it to LN, RN, and KD.
Now, was this testimony under oath in court, or are you talking about the
initial? This is the initial reports.
Okay.
This
whole argument about under oath as opposed to what you tell your mother, your interviewer, whatever, the policeman who is pushing on this. What can the jury really depend on here? Because those are out-of-court statements. And then you have in-court statements under oath where evidently they testified to something else in varying degrees. So you're relying on all this out-of-court statement. Is that Is that what we should be looking at? Or was the jury looking at the out-of-court or the in-court, or how was that handled?
Well, I can't present to the court what the jury did consider, but I can present to the court there was certainly evidence for the jury to conclude that these girls' testimony, all in all, was very consistent in terms of certain things that had happened. What they told the social worker, what they told the doctor, what they told their parents, what they told law enforcement.
Did they come in as prior consistent statements then, or how did it come into evidence if they were testifying under oath in court?
I'm trying to remember the record, and so if I misspeak, I apologize.
And I apologize. I have not had a chance to read it yet either.
Well, so. I think it came in as prior consistent, prior statements, victim statements to law enforcement, and the state was showing how consistently these girls actually were on the main events. The state isn't going to stand before you and say that there weren't some inconsistencies with these little girls and what they said, and 10 years later. And remember, even 10 years later, they're 17 and 18 years old. They've hardly seasoned lives. And they had to relive something that was traumatic in their lives 10 years ago. And even then, these girls are quite consistent in their statements.
Now, one thing that's troubling, and Mr. Wrench brought up, was that a specific element of rape in the first degree and pedophilia is penetration. All the statements you're talking about, as I went through trying to sort it out, what specific evidence did the state have of testimony of penetration?
Well, each of the girls...
Because everything you've talked about up to now is, well, he attempted, and some vague statements, but that's not what the statutes require.
Well, if I've led you to believe it was an attempt, I apologize, because I think that's not what the record would support. All four victims testified, and TT testified too. And what they testified first, KD, the night of the birthday, there was bad touch that went on in her dad's bedroom. She testified to LR's vagina being touched by her dad's penis. This is what, and these girls used diagrams when they were interviewed by law enforcement initially at 7 and 8. And those diagrams were how they were able to explain to law enforcement. And the jury got to see those diagrams. They were admitted into evidence of how these girls' vaginas and defendant's penis came in contact with one another. And as Justice Gilbertson pointed out, the statute says however slight. And, How deep the penetration went, there's no evidence in terms of the depth of penetration, and I'm not going to stand here and tell you there is, but these girls all talked about it hurt bad, he pushed hard, there were things like that in the record, which certainly lends to the jury's finding that there was penetration, however slight. They talked about NR, KD first talked about NR's, well, both LR and NR's vaginas being touched by her father's penis. She said NR screamed, and defendant told KD, instructed KD to cover NR's mouth. And that is a consistent story you hear from those girls, that the defendant instructed his daughter to cover another girl's mouth because she was going to scream, and the evidence shows that a grandma was living there at the time. And KD talked about how they were all touched in a bad way, and she also touched about how she testified to her father tried to lick her privates. She also testified, and I think this is important in terms of KD and that first issue as to whether the evidence is sufficient to sustain the conviction, something that the evidence shows and is in the record, that there's a grandmother who put a considerable amount of pressure on KD to recant her stories and told her to write letters saying that this didn't happen. She also testified that those letters recanting her statements were false. Now, it's true on cross-examination, she said the defendant didn't do anything with his penis and her vagina, but she also said that her recantations were false. So, as one of the justices asked, isn't that a question for the jury? We also have SRB, who testified that the defendant touched her in a bad way, and the other girls watched it happen. And she testified at 17 or 18 that defendant's dick touched her vagina. Those were her words, obviously. It burned and it hurt. LR testified. Defendant touched her and the other girls on two occasions. He touched his penis on their vaginas. She also testified how NR screamed. KD covered her mouth at her father's instructions. She was hurt and she was crying. That's evidence of penetration, I would argue. Finally, NR testified as well. Defendant touched her in a bad way. LR and KD held her down. Defendant put his penis in her. That's what I believe the testimony is, and if I have it wrong, I apologize, but I believe that would be her testimony. And KD covered her mouth, and it was disgusting and it hurt. Each of these girls talks about how it hurt. That, to me, is evidence of penetration. TT, who, as Mr. Wrench pointed out, the defendant was not convicted ultimately of any acts against her. However, she testified. She testified that she wasn't touched by the defendant. However, she said she observed the bad touch by defendant on KD and LR. As a result, defendant was convicted of those five counts. Now, defendant's arguing that the evidence isn't sufficient to sustain the conviction against his daughter, the two counts of rape, because on cross-examination, she said her dad never touched her vagina with his penis. However, there's other statements that she's given where she said that did happen. And that is a jury question.
Were they closer in time to the alleged date of the rape?
They were after the rape. Within a month, I think the rapes occurred in July and September of 98, and she was interviewed by law enforcement on two different occasions in October of 98.
But can you use those?
They were used. Well,
can an out-of-court statement be used to prove something when she testifies differently in court?
But she didn't totally testify differently. I think that's an important point that has to be made here. She said at her birthday, bad touch occurred. This is her current testimony in the current trial. And she was forced to write letters denying her father touched her or hurt her. She said those letters were false. She testified to that. And then the jury heard about her two interviews where she said something different. And the jury got to watch and listen to those interviews. Defendant, she said, touched her in a private area with his private area. And they used diagrams, and she was able to, if I remember right, she put crosses on what areas of the bodies touched. And she made statements that they did sex, and it hurt bad. She talked about it hurting bad. She also told social worker Horn after the second interview, where she once again recanted things, and we're going back to October of 98, KD said defendant touched her, and it hurt. Importantly enough, she also told the doctor who examined her and the other four girls, when asked, did someone hurt you? She said yes, down in your pointed to her vaginal area, I believe the record shows. She said, defendant, her father, touched her in her private areas. So she made an admission to the doctor, she made an admission to the social worker that she had lied and that actually he had touched her. She talked about her grandma made her write letters that said it hadn't happened and those letters were false. The jury heard all that. They also heard testimony from an officer who interviewed her, and they heard testimony of the young girls who watched this happen. Because the testimony is he traipsed all these little girls into his bedroom and he raped them one after another after another. LR testified she saw defendant touch KD's vagina with his penis two times, and that is consistent with the record. July 10th, KD's birthday, and September 11th, 98. SRB also testified at trial that defendant touched KD in a bad way. TT testified she observed defendant touch KD between the legs. She called it bunny, and that she testified to seeing the bad touch by defendant on KD. It's the state's position that based upon all of that evidence, which was consistent with interviews and statements given to doctors who examined her, the evidence was sufficient for a jury to find a rational theory of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, and that those two counts should stand. The next issue that defendant argued was the issue in reference to the jury's misconduct and the motion for new trial that was denied by the trial court. And as Justice Gilbertson noted, it was the same judge that presided over the Russo case and granted a new trial. There are three hearings, in reference to this particular issue. Juror affidavits were submitted, and sworn testimony was subject to cross-examination of 11 of those, or excuse me, all 12 of the jurors. And the state, based upon the affidavits and the sworn testimony of each of those jurors, and after all those hearings, the trial court found the state had overcome the presumption of prejudice that applies when there's jury misconduct. And the court did find that there was some jury misconduct. SDCL 1914-7 applies in this case. That is the statute that limits the type of information a juror can provide via affidavit or under oath in support of a new trial. And that statute clearly prohibits intrinsic information, which goes to statements and or discussions during deliberations. Here, there is no question that a pretrial motion in limine was brought before the court by both parties. The state asked that the defendant not be allowed to talk about his acquittals on various counts, and the defendant asked that the state not be able to bring in any previous trial, convictions, sentences, or that defendant was in prison or previous rulings from the prior trial. Nobody objected to any of the motions in limine, so the court granted the order. And it relied, the court relied on Federal Rules of Evidence 401 and 403. I think it's important that it be noted that in an April 24th, 2008 hearing, the court granted those motions in limine, but it advised the parties. The witnesses, we have five witnesses who are going to be impeached with prior transcripts. And the court cautioned that those witnesses be prepared and to refer to that prior trial and those prior trial transcripts as prior proceedings or hearings. And the court recognized that it was going to be difficult for those witnesses to keep that in mind, and that the jury was, there was going to be some speculation on the part of the jury as to why there was a 10-year delay. And I think as what was pointed out, there was no discussion as to what part of 403 the court was granting the motion. It was, quite frankly, they were not objected to by either party. Everybody involved recognized that it would be good to keep all that information out from the jury. This ended up being a five-day trial. Witnesses were cross-examined, ambiguously cross-examined, with 10-year-old testimony. And as been pointed out, there was certainly some inconsistencies in testimony, as there's bound to be when you have 7- and 8-year-old witnesses who are 17 and 18 coming before the court and having to relive a very traumatic event or events. In the end, the court decides to give a jury instruction, and it's jury instruction 28 at settled record 990, where the court advises the jury there's a previous trial. The defendant was tried before, and you should not consider the fact that there was a previous trial when you deliberate. And the court is quite clear why it did that in its March 30th, 2008 hearing referencing these juror misconduct allegations, because it was so apparent that the jurors already knew it, so the court felt it important that they advised the jury not to consider that information. The court recognized the issue and advised specifically the jurors, and it's on page 8, I believe, of that transcript.
Did either of the parties request that instruction, or did the court?
The court. I believe it was the court. I believe it was the court. The court. This is on page 28, excuse me, of a motion hearing dated July 30th. So this information was given to the jury through instruction 28, talking about the prior trial. It was the court's original intention that all of this information be kept out, however, regarding the prior trial. However, there was extensive cross-examination by the use of prior transcripts and references to prior proceedings, and the information was elicited through cross-examination in the case. So it was before the jury. At that point, the court talked with counsel about the need to instruct on this, and the court, in fact, had proposed an instruction. And I believe that the parties agreed, and there was no objection to instruction number 28. And goes on. It's page 28, a motion hearing transcript dated July 30th. This motion for a new trial comes 2 months after the jury had convicted defendant, and there's alleged jury misconduct. There's an affidavit filed by the jury foreman. And I've read the testimony of each of those jurors, and there's some inconsistencies as to when these statements were made, but it's clear there was discussion about why did it take 10 years, and somebody said something about, there was, first of all, it was a new, there had been a previous trial, which they had already been instructed on, and then somebody said something about there was an incompetent counsel. Now, I also went back and I read the testimony of the juror who claimed or admitted that she was the one who said, I'm the one who said he had incompetent counsel. When asked, did you know that was the reason for a new trial? She said no. There's testimony now, 2 months later, as to the jurors discussing that, but I don't know where that all fell into it. But what's important is all of the jurors, I think, testified. Those statements were made, but it wasn't discussed any further. Couldn't remember when it was said. It was just something that was made, and everybody moved on.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Mr. Wrench, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Okay, where to begin? It's interesting that we start this whole thing out by talking about whether there's sufficient evidence to support two rape convictions because the alleged victim essentially says something under oath that, in our view, negates the possibility of the state's theory of rape. With all that said, as to whether or not, as a matter of law, it's insufficient, one must ask this question. If that's the position taken at trial by the alleged victim, and if she's previously recanted and said that there's been no touching by her father, does that not cause a person to pause or hesitate? Is that not information that shows that it's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt? It's certainly something that a reasonable juror should look at and seriously question whether or not there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Then the question becomes, well, why still convict? Why still convict? Why still convict is because the trial was unfair. Why still convict? Because the information that was supposed to be precluded from this trial made its way into the sanctity of the jury room. The information about him being in prison had no place there. It never would have come in under any circumstances. There's no way to make it relevant. It's more prejudicial than probative. It hurts. It hurts when someone is viewed as a convict. That's why it was kept out. That started off the deliberations. It was discussed for 3 to 5 minutes if you listen to the jury testimony of Juror McVeigh. And then at the end, we have this information about incompetent counsel. We have a case here that is not a case of overwhelming proof of guilt. We have a case here where we were in the race. We were showing through the prior testimony of the alleged victims that what they said at trial was subject to great question. The state has been making the point about SRB and how she said that she was raped on the night of the birthday party. 3 times she had denied to the investigator that she was raped on the night of the birthday party in her first statement. She'd also specifically recounted that she was not there on the night of the birthday party because Dad did not want her spending the night over there when he was home because he thought he might hurt me or something. He won't let me spend the night over there because he thinks Dylan touches me places, but he doesn't. This is what SRB says right off the bat in the very first interview. She denies it and denies it and denies it. And then, as she's being questioned, she starts to say different things. One thing that's kind of been lost in the analysis here is the fact that there was a great deal of interviewer bias on the part of the investigating officer. She was out to get Farrell Dylan. She said on October 9th, before she had even interviewed two of the witnesses, that she was already up to 7 life sentences. We presented testimony to the effect that her interviews were not in keeping with the standards of the industry and they had many errors which could create false memories, errors which could enforce a certain answer or by continually not believing what a child says about one thing causes them to say another. Those statements are greatly, greatly into question. TT, talk about TT claiming that she could see something through the door. She twice denied ever seeing anything to a therapist. That was brought out on cross-examination. LR said her sister was there on one night, and then when she's kind of caught in a little lie because the facts aren't matching up, she says, no, my sister wasn't there, I'm sorry. And then she asks, what did my sister tell you? There are funny things going on with these various statements. And because of that, those statements are subject to great question. Can a typical, rational juror looking at that, who can get aside from the prejudice of these terrible types of charges, would have found something substantial by way of reasonable doubt? And what explains that not occurring? We've got this improper vouching by the psychiatrist, the psychologist. We've got this unique circumstance that no one's ever heard of in South Dakota, where the children's shoes are lined up in the hall, and we have this circumstance where this improper information, this very information which the state agreed should be kept out, was kept out. I want to clarify and respond to something else. I didn't elicit on cross that there was a previous trial. Look at jury trial pages 370 and 597. That's when the information came in. I'm referring to prior testimony exactly the way the court told me to refer to prior testimony, and I'm dealing with the alleged victims at that point in time, and they both say, you mean the prior trial. It's interesting that two of them said that. Here we have a situation where the trial that this man had was unfair for many reasons. On any one of these issues, a retrial could be granted.
How long did the jury deliberate?
I think about 4.5 to 5 hours, as I recall it, although I don't have the docket sheet that says the exact time. That's my recollection. On any one of these issues, a retrial should be granted, but when you look at all of them combined together, you can see the great unfairness in this case. One issue that I wasn't, you know, that I just mentioned at the very end of my argument the last time was this issue about hearsay. You know, there were 3 or 4 times on the record where I objected to the hearsay of the state, and of course, you know, it was overruled, and the information comes in.
The purpose of rebuttal is to rebut what the state said. I think you're wandering into new territory here.
All right. Well, I thought I'd give it a try.
Well, you got to try.
All right. Just remember my brief. Another thing that I wanted to point out, too, we can talk, you know, and the statements can be read to you time and time again about what the children said when they said it and what they testified to when they testified to it. I spent more time in my brief than I ever have in any other outlining these long and lengthy statements and footnoting them with various inconsistencies. And should you wish to see how different the testimony ends up between the first statement, the second statement, and on, the brief sets forth those very different inconsistencies. In the end, this was a case where there were recantations, where there were denials, where there were claims that people weren't even there on the evening in question, and where unequivocally you had Farrell Dillon saying, I didn't do this. And the state's responding by saying, well, he'd be mad if he were telling the truth. I need to step away and get a sip of water.
Sure, just bring it up there with you.
You have the situation where he comes in and he says, I didn't do this. I didn't do this. And he was polite to the officers, and he answered their questions. And the state argues it at the end and says that if he really didn't do this, he wouldn't have acted that way. He would have been mad. He would have been angry and all of this stuff. We have a situation where it's a he said, she said. There's no physical evidence to tell us otherwise. We also have the testimony of both experts, the state's and the defendants, that these types of child molestation, it's very unusual that it would happen this way, that it would happen one after the other with witnesses and with the use of a child helping and things like that. So in the end, I would ask that you enforce the jury misconduct information, enforce the jury misconduct rule, and grant him a trial. And finally, I want to leave you with this comment about, you know, the psychologist saying that if they say it's happened in the majority of the cases, it's the truth. You know, I always run into this in these child molestation cases when I'm trying them. They bring in the experts, and they get to talk about the symptoms, about the characteristics of abused children. And, you know, that's fine. We can talk about characteristics of abused children and try to, you know, give the jury some information that will help them and then try to argue the case and meet it fairly. And when I know what those characteristics are, I can have my expert counter or clarify or whatever. But one thing that I can never do, is I never really have any way to enforce the experts from not saying what it is that they're not supposed to say. Saying that when children say it happens, in the majority of the cases, it's the truth. That is something that should not be said in any trial. These cases are too close for that. A defendant who's facing this charge, we can talk about the presumption of innocence all day long, but a defendant who's facing these charges is in a much harder position than people with other offenses. And when an expert says something like that before these kids testify, that is a bell that cannot be unrung. That is something that cannot be wiped away from the minds of the jurors, even if they try it. Because when the child gets on the stand and says it happened, it's easy for that shadow of a thought to flicker through their mind. Well, if they say it happened in the majority of the cases, it must be true. That's the antithesis of the presumption of innocence. So I would ask you, in this case, to please put some teeth behind this rule that the experts aren't supposed to invade the process of the jurors in determining the credibility of the witnesses, and that the experts are not supposed to violate this hornbook law rule that says you can't go in and say that people are telling the truth or infer that a person in the majority of the case is telling the truth, because there's really no basis in fact for that, and something like that is the opposite of what we require, which is to presume someone innocent at the outset. And if you have an expert saying, well, the majority of the cases, if they say it's true, then it happened, that makes our presumption of innocence instruction something that is somewhat of a nullity. Thank you for listening to me, and please revisit this case.
Thank you, Mr. Wrench. The court will be in recess.